President Trump will meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping on Thursday at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. It's the first meeting between the two leaders, who represent two of the most powerful countries on Earth. But according to Gideon Rockman, chief foreign affairs commentator for the Financial Times, one of those powers is on the rise, the other declining. His new book is called Easternization: Asia's Rise and America's Decline from Obama to Trump and Beyond. Gideon, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
And we've been talking about this idea for a long time. Has it happened yet?
Yeah, I think it has. I mean, obviously, people have been preoccupied by the rise of Asia on and off for many years. But I think you could look at the Obama years as a moment when quite important things happened. So that, for example, in 2014, the IMF came out with a ranking of the world's largest economies. And for the first time ever, they said that China, at least ranked by purchasing power, which is one way of doing it, is now the largest economy in the world. And in other ways, in the last 10 years, China's become the largest manufacturer in the world, the largest exporter in the world. And it's part of a broader phenomenon of growing Asian power. So in that ranking the IMF came up with, of the four top nations, three were in Asia. China, the US was second, and then there was Japan and India. And so the economic center of gravity of the world, I think, has now pretty clearly moved towards the Asia Pacific.
Does it matter, though, that the US is still the biggest military power?
Oh, sure, it does. Absolutely. And I think it sets up a tension because the US is still clearly the biggest military power. And it's also the biggest political power. It's the only superpower in the world. That's been that case ever since the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the question really that the book wrestles with in different ways is, how is this mismatch between the shift of economic power towards Asia, how is that going to play out against the background of a world in which, in political and military terms, the U.S. is still number one?
Well, and obviously, we're also dealing with changing leadership in the United States from Obama to Trump. And there was a phone call that happened right away after Trump was elected between him and the Taiwanese president, which was a major break with the U.S. practice of how to deal with Taiwan, which China sees as a rebel province. How big of a deal was that?
At the time, it felt like a huge deal because I'd been in Beijing just a few weeks before the election. And although the Chinese wouldn't quite say it, it seemed to me pretty clear that they actually wanted Trump rather than Hillary Clinton, who they regarded as somebody who was bent on pushing back quite hard against China. And they thought Trump was more of a soft touch, if you like. Hmm. And then he makes this phone call to the president of Taiwan, or rather accepts a call from her, which is a complete violation of this rather odd deal that the U.S. struck at the time of the 1970s when America recognized the People's Republic of China. It de-recognized Taiwan, and they've never spoken to the leader of Taiwan ever since. So it was a total slap in the face from Trump towards China. China's indeed said on many occasions that it would actually go to war rather than allow Taiwanese independence. However, the Chinese at that point just said, OK, well, we're not even going to speak to Donald Trump until he rose back from this. And indeed, when Trump did finally speak to President Xi Jinping, he acknowledged the one China policy. Initially, it looked like a sign of Trump's confrontationalism. Then it looked like a sign of his naivety, that he'd made this big step, justified it shortly afterwards, and then was forced to back down. But I think more than either of those things, it's a sign of his unpredictability, because he sent out very mixed signals on China at times, talking very tough, not just over Taiwan, but also over the South China Sea. And then the biggest issue of all, I guess, is trade, because Trump is an out-and-out protectionist,
right?
Talked in the campaign about China raping American industry, threatened 45% tariffs on Chinese goods. If he were to pursue any of that, it would be an incredible reversal in the U.S.-Chinese relationship, which would swiftly become very antagonistic.
Well, you point out in this book that China is constantly just pushing boundaries to see how far it can go. And I wonder, how does China react when countries push back? Do they back off or do they stand firm?
It depends which country, to be honest. I think increasingly the Chinese have been learning that they can push around almost anybody except the United States. But that doesn't mean that they are prepared to defer to America. It just means that they will be a bit more subtle in the way that they use their power, so that they've advanced through sort of little steps in the South China Sea, building up their territorial claims. They certainly don't accept America's naval operations there, but they've tried to avoid direct confrontation. Whereas with other countries, smaller countries, it's much more evident that China now is really willing to throw its weight around in a way, frankly, that the US might have done in the past. So that just to give you a single example, but at the moment, South Korea, because of the North Korean nuclear threat, has agreed to accept a missile system or an anti-missile system called THAAD from the Americans. The Chinese are very angry about it because they believe it threatens their own nuclear deterrent. So they've started cancelling contracts with South Korean companies. South Korean sort of soap operas are no longer being shown on Chinese television. There's a real push on. And for South Korea, which is a booming economy, but one which increasingly looks much more to China than to the United States, this is a very tough situation. And it's just a sign of how much more willing China is to throw its weight around.
We're speaking with Gideon Rachman, whose new book is called Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline. And let's talk about numbers, because you cite an estimate that by 2025, two-thirds of the world's population will live in Asia, whereas the U.S. will be 5% of the world's population, the EU 7%. How important are the sheer numbers of population? Can you be the superpower in the world for a long time if you have such a smaller population than another country?
Well, I think that the weight of population does matter now much more than it did in the past. Because in the old days, the wealth gap between the advanced Western nations, and particularly the US, but also the Western Europeans and Asia, was so huge that it didn't really matter that, you know, there were hundreds of millions of Chinese, now 1.4 billion, 1.3 billion Indians, because they were very poor. So the Chinese economy, the Indian economy, was still smaller. That economic gap has narrowed. So the average Chinese is now about probably only about 25% as rich as the average American. But when you have that population, cumulatively, the economy is larger or as large, depends on the unit of measurement you want to use. And the same goes for India, which was a very poor country. There's still many people living in absolute poverty in India, but because they've been on the move economically, growing at 8, 9, 10% a year, they are now a big economy. But in response to your question about, well, can America continue to be the superpower? Yes, for a while, because it has other assets. It has allies, for example. There is such a thing as the Western Alliance. There is no Eastern Alliance. Asia's very, very divided. And that's really the key to American power in Asia, is that a lot of the Asian countries don't necessarily side with China. In fact, they're very scared of China, and they want the U.S. to stay a presence in the region. And Trump, for example, has been very wary of allies, regards them as exploiting America's security guarantees, regards countries like Japan and South Korea as almost as bad on trade as the Chinese. So there is that. And then I think the other thing is that there's a big question about American will. Would America really fight over rocks in the South China Sea? Would it really fight to protect outlying bits of territory of Japan? And as long as the Chinese can plant doubts about that, and some of Trump's rhetoric reinforces those doubts, then there's always a question mark to America's allies in the region. You know, is America really going to be a big Pacific power?
Well, and it sounds like America is not willing to step in a lot of these places. I mean, if you look at the fact that Japan wants to, you know, have a military again after all these years, and what happened with the Arab Spring and where America stepped in and where it didn't step in, it doesn't sound like the will is really there to be the global policeman, which I guess you have to be if you want to be the ruler of the world.
Certainly the questions were raised during the Obama years by, I think, above all, the Arab Spring. There was the famous episode of the Syrian red line where, right, Obama said, if Assad uses chemical weapons, that's a red line. And America came very close to deploying military power and then didn't. And whatever you think of the merits of that decision on its own, people somehow interpreted it as a symbolic moment, as a moment where America had decided, you know what, we're not going to do this anymore. And I think that was an overinterpretation of that decision. But interpretation matters, because a lot of power and a lot of deterrence is about perception. People have to believe you're going to do this, that you will live up to your security commitment, whether it's to Japan or to the Baltic states. And if they begin to think, well, maybe they won't, then you have your adversaries, whether it's China or Russia, begin to think, you know, maybe we can test this and right. we might kind of advance a little bit. But it's a big dilemma for America, because actually, I mean, you say it's clear that America won't come to the aid of Japan. Well, Obama did go to Tokyo, I think in 2013, and say the Senkaku Islands, which are these disputed rocks between Japan and China, quite close to the Chinese coast, that they are covered by the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty. In other words, if China were actually to try to take them by force and the Chinese military buzzes in and around them, that America would essentially go to war to protect those uninhabited reefs. So he was very much trying to reinforce the doctrine of deterrence. And in a sense, it's worked because the Chinese haven't invaded. But I don't think the question mark has been removed.
That's Gideon Rockman of the Financial Times. His new book is Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline from Obama to Trump and Beyond. We'll continue our conversation tomorrow, right here on Here and Now.